It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. We're now on our way to an affluent suburb on the East Coast. It's a real town with a fake name used to protect the town's residents. Woodcrest. Now, the majority are white and well-educated, though there are a handful of Black and Latinx students bused in from other towns. There's also a growing Asian American population, mostly Chinese and Indian American families who've moved here and enrolled their children in the local schools, where they've excelled academically. In fact, they're outperforming everyone else. Now, just a quick aside here. Asian Americans have long been dubbed a so-called model minority. Quiet, hardworking, ultimately successful. But that's a harmful trope that fails to recognize the diversity within the AAPI community and is often used to silence and minimize stories of struggle and hardship. The tensions in this town are very real between Asian Americans and white families, whose children compete for the highest grades, top rankings, and the best transcripts to submit to colleges. And while these groups fight it out at the top of the heap, children with less access to advanced placement classes, extracurricular activities, and after-school tutoring are left with much less opportunity to compete with their white and Asian American classmates. Natasha Warwicku, professor of sociology at Tufts University, spent a lot of time observing families in Woodcrest for her book, Race at the Top, Asian Americans and Whites in Pursuit of the American Dream in Suburban Schools. I asked Natasha to join us and talk about her findings, and perhaps tell us where Woodcrest really is.
It's on the East Coast. But really, I think the important point is that there are a lot of Woodcrest, and there are a lot of, you know, communities like this that are kind of mostly upper middle class, predominantly white, but with a large and growing Asian American population, and where there's a lot of kind of academic competition in schools and, you know, high achieving adults, high levels of education. Woodcrest is everywhere, I'll say that.
What took you to Woodcrest intellectually?
I'm a scholar of immigration and inequality in education. And, you know, there was this idea that kind of the move of immigrant families over generations to inner ring suburbs, outer ring suburbs was a process of assimilation, right? That over generations and over time, families would move to the suburbs and kind of blend in with the dominant group. This is what we saw for Eastern and Southern European immigrants, for Jewish immigrants. And the question is often, well, is that going to happen with Asian Americans? Because Asian Americans are doing well socioeconomically in general. But I just had a sense that the situation was different and that there are these tensions. And I kind of felt rumblings about this. You know, Asian Americans obviously are not white and get racialized in particular ways. And so I really wanted to just investigate, like, what happens when Asian Americans move to the suburbs and do so in large numbers and are doing well academically? How do their white neighbors respond? How do they kind of navigate social life? Do they kind of blend into whiteness? Are there marks of distinction? So these are the questions that I kind of went into this community wondering about.
When you talk about the race at the top, not the race to the top, tell me about white folks and Asian Americans and their children and how it is that they're already at the top, but still racing one another.
When you add in this ethnic change dimension, I think sometimes it can feel like, well, then do Asian Americans get blamed for that increased competition where, you know, if they're not there, it's just this is the way of the world. And I call it a race at the top because there's intense competition in these places. And sometimes that gets racialized as Asian Americans are trying to get ahead in the wrong ways or whites are doing things differently. But what they don't realize is that they're all at the top. And the ones who really lose out are the kids and families who can't afford to move to places like this, who are not even in this race because they don't have the economic resources, the sort of cultural knowledge. And so that competition, I argue, kind of makes it seem fair and like it's a meritocracy and the sort of quote unquote the best really get what they deserve. When kids who are not in this community, whose parents don't have the same resources, are kind of locked out of that competition.
Now, I got to say, as a parent, you really engage in this question of how what's going on with young people is often fueled by our angst and anxiety as parents, our belief about what constitutes good parenting, and our judgment of others' parenting.
we live in an era where we place so much stake in parenting and what it means to be a good parent. It's almost a moralistic, my sense of self-worth is dependent on how I see myself as a parent, you know, and, you know, I'm a parent as well. So I get it, right? If I don't, am I a bad parent if I don't show up to that softball game, right? And so there's this anxiety of, you know, all the other moms are there. Why am I not there? It's very different, right? And I think this is across racial lines. I think there is this sort of contemporary sort of intensive parenting, this sense of, you know, we need to do everything that we can to help our kids get ahead. And, you know, I think all parents do that. We have different resources and different ways of doing that. But I think that that's part of what fuels this intense need to sort of self-justify as well, right? Well, if you're not doing things the way I'm doing it, you must be a bad parent. And even if your kid is getting ahead and doing well, because I didn't do things the way you did, then I rather than feel like somehow inadequate, I have to judge you, right? And say, well, that's not the right way to do things.
I guess part of what I found most telling was this idea that what constitutes good parenting also has these racialized and immigrant versus native implications around particularly like the choice that young people can make themselves, right? So the extent to which one values sort of self-expression or young people making their own choices versus adult direction.
We do know from some of the cross-cultural studies that there's less emphasis on autonomy than there is in the West, right? So we know that that's true, although in kind of urban middle-class communities in those countries, that's also changing, I think in part because of the Western influence. And I definitely saw the Asian parents in this community were mostly immigrant parents. And I definitely saw a little bit of that difference, like a lot less anxiety about, you know, whether their kids are choosing what they're doing or not. But I also think there are ways in which upper middle class white American parents are also directive, but sort of they need to convince themselves that their children have chosen what they've chosen. There's less choice than we think in kind of upper middle class white American families, and there's more choice than we think in among Asian parents as well.
Pause for just a minute with me. We'll be right back with more of our conversation with Natasha Waraku right here on The Takeaway.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I've been speaking with Professor Natasha Waraku about her book, Race at the Top, Asian Americans and Whites in Pursuit of the American Dream in Suburban Schools. We discussed how white families are advocating for their children and possibly changing policies to help them compete against the Asian American students who are outperforming them in school.
None of this is sort of overt, right? So no one is saying, you know, well, Asian kids are doing well academically, so we should not publish class rank anymore, right? So there's this, just this sense of like, you know, maybe class rank is not such a good thing, so let's eliminate it. Or, you know, let's not name a valedictorian, you know, and perhaps it's not a coincidence that every valedictorian or whatever is Asian American. And so, you know, one of the things that came up when I was doing this research was homework. So different ideas about how much homework kids should get, in part because white students were more likely to be doing a lot of intensive extracurricular activities, especially in high school. And so the school district decided to, you know, do this pilot, and then they expanded this idea of no homework in elementary school. And at the high school, there were certain parameters, like you couldn't give homework on any religious holiday or long weekends or what have you. And there was a lot of difference in terms of how people, like whether people thought this is a good thing. And so, you know, again, it was white parents' solution to, well, our kids are stressed out. We need to, like, if there's too much going on, we need to reduce the stress. And Asian parents saying, well, we agree that our kids are stressed out. We need to address it, but we think homework is important, or our kids aren't doing activities till 9 o'clock at night. So our little more homework is not going to, you know, keep them up till midnight the way it might if they're getting home much later. And so just different ideas about how kids should be spending their time. Again, you know, I think it was not a deliberate, you know, this is going to advantage whites, but in fact, their solution to mental health was, okay, let's reduce homework. And maybe that will sort of level the playing field a little bit in terms of academic standards.
How do you define academic excellence? And maybe not, maybe less you, but how are parents defining what constitutes academic excellence?
I use the word achievement more broadly, right? Because academics is just one piece of achievement. And I think in the US, you know, we have a much more holistic view of achievement, right? And college, and in part, you know, I think all of this is sort of looking towards the college application process. And US selective colleges are looking at students holistically, right? It's not just, you have to be strong academically, but you also have to have extracurriculars. And you know what, the hardest to get into colleges, you have to have, you've got to be, they call it pointy, right? You've got to be really good at something. And I think the white parents kind of understand that, right? Because they've gone through the college admissions process in the United States. A lot of these parents in this community have gone to elite American colleges. Asian parents in this community, who are mostly immigrants, they went to college in, so these are mostly Chinese and Indian parents who are highly educated. In their experience, getting into college is all about a standardized test. And they understand that it's different in the US, but they, you know, I think it's, I call it these cultural repertoires that we have in our head, like ways of doing things or your kind of intuition about how to get ahead. And they're really focused on, like, I was really great academically. I went to after school academic classes. That's what led me to success. And they're imparting that on their kids. So they're like, yeah, you got to do an extracurricular, but don't let it take over your life. So I had, you know, Asian parents telling me, like, remember this one mom being like, I told my son, quit the swim team. You're not getting your homework done. You're too stressed out. Quit swimming. But she was like, he wouldn't do it. Right. So, you know, it's not that kids always do what their parents tell them to do, but that was her solution. It's too much. You know, take your 4 honors classes, but quit the varsity swim team, which is really intensive.
Talk to me more about what it means for communities who are neither white nor Asian American, and maybe who are less well-resourced, to be engaging in a school system, maybe applying to the same colleges as the folks who have been having this kind of battle at the woodcrest of our country.
I mean, I think it's important to remember that communities like Woodcrest, a lot of suburbs, were kind of created in part because of racial integration, right? It was a way for whites to move out to these suburbs, these communities that were sort of to leave the city at a time of, again, school integration, to create these kind of havens of class and racial segregation. But it was now like it was a community of choice. You know, that's the start. And then these communities enacted laws like single family home laws, where you could only build single family housing, where, you know, minimum lot size policies to keep people out who are working class. And, you know, it's kind of a thinly veiled attempt, I think, at that in those periods to keep out African American working class in particular. And so this is the sort of foundation of these kinds of communities. And so it's kind of an irony that Asian Americans are able to sort of take advantage of this class and racial segregation because of U.S. immigration policy. That means that a majority of Asian immigrants are coming with high levels of education and, you know, have the incomes and resources to be able to move into these communities and don't experience the same kinds of racial discrimination in the housing market. If we can understand that, we can see the ways that these havens of privilege are really then disadvantaging those kids who are, you know, not even in the game, don't even know the game. So when you're saying applying, they're often not even applying to those colleges because they don't see themselves as candidates for those places. That's the story I'm trying to tell, that these are like places of incredible privilege and Asian Americans are sometimes benefiting from that, even if there is this tension between whites and Asians in these communities.
Do you see solutions to this?
You know, in some ways, my solution is about housing policy. It's about more mixed income housing. It's about bringing public transportation to the suburbs. But it's also about, you know, teaching kids about the privileges that they have and helping them see that, yeah, you know, you did work really hard. You practiced that violin every day for an hour, for 2 hours. But there are kids who never have that opportunity. And I think, you know, it's easy to miss that when it's like, wow, God, I practice an hour every day, but the kid next door practiced 2 hours a day. And so they won the competition and I got second place, right? And it's easy to forget that some kids are not even in the race. And I think helping them understand that, I think, is incredibly important, but also changing our policies so that we don't have such separation by class and race in this country.
Natasha Waruku is professor of sociology at Tufts University and author of Race at the Top. Thanks for joining us.
It's so good to be here. Thanks for having me.